I mean, you can only go so far with just one avenue of diving. You gotta try it all. I push myself every year. I do a couple different courses, whether it's rebreather, cave, side mount, free diving. I kind of want to just learn everything I possibly can for an underwater world and to, you know, make myself into a better diver.
It's episode 38 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Maxwell Hone. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, your favorite podcast about all types of diving, scuba tech, free diving, and more. We cover it all. Every week on Monday, we post new episodes filled with diving news, interesting dive topics, ocean advocacy, and much more. To learn more about the show, find your favorite guest, or just read up about the host, check out our website, diveinpod.com. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm Nick.
I'm Amit.
And we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast. April's not with us tonight. She's on a big adventure. We'll chat about more next week, I'm sure. Until then, we'll talk about tonight's guest. Tonight, we're speaking to Maxwell Hone. Maxwell is a Canadian adventurer, photographer, and filmmaker based on the West Coast. His list of qualifications and accomplishments include being a commercial diving instructor, tech diver, cave diver, certified drone pilot, published photographer, and Huish Outdoors brand ambassador. Along with Underwater Pat, he's also the second winner of the Monterey Shootout we've had on the podcast in just the last couple weeks. Maxwell's passion for the ocean is evident in his photos and videos, especially when he's documenting the underwater scenes of beautiful British Columbia. Welcome to the podcast, Maxwell. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Pleasure's all ours. How are you doing today?
Not too bad, thanks. Just got out of the water about an hour ago, and I've still got the wrinkles on my face from my mask, but slowly trying out.
A true diver.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to our interview with you in a few minutes, Maxwell. But briefly before that, we'll have a quick chat about last week's episode. Nick, you set up the interview with Christina, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great to talk sharks and cave diving. And I know Amit had a great time talking about cave diving too.
Oh, yeah. You know, overall, like she is, well, really, she's a powerhouse in diving. There's no question about it. And I think given me the option to, I would have kept on going for the rest of the night. So I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that. And, you know, and I'm just trying to figure out, like, there are so many awesome guests we've had on the show, and how do I get to dive with all of these people, right? So it was rough, but she was special too. Yeah, yeah. And the post conversations that we had, I think were also really, really cool. So her passion comes through for all things diving and the way that she kind of translates that. So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, most definitely. And I'm sure we'll be saying the same things in a week about you, Maxwell.
I hope so.
I hear you're a bit of a free diver, and we'll probably talk more about that in a little bit, but how familiar would you say you are with bottlenose dolphins and their breath holds?
Oh, I mean, I've come across them in few occasions, but I'm no expert by any means. I have led dives in Zanzibar in Eastern Africa, and wow. I look back to check and count my divers, and I'd be joined by a group of dolphins, so...
Wow, that's
sounds
really
terrible.
Awesome.
I don't know how you made it through.
So new research was published in the Frontiers of Physiology that shows bottlenose dolphins can actively control their heart rates for breath holds and slowing their heart rates down even more when they're doing longer or deeper dives. Quote, when we asked them to hold their breath, their heart rates lowered before or immediately as they began the breath hold. We also observed that dolphins reduce their heart rates faster and further when preparing for long breath holds as compared to the other breath holds, end quote. So the lower the heart rate means they can conserve oxygen. They also absorb less nitrogen, apparently allowing them to avoid getting the bends, which is something I really never thought about with dolphins and other marine mammals. So there's a lot of great information in the article, but the most interesting thing that I saw was they're talking about loud man-made noises underwater interrupting these processes. And they said, quote, man-made sounds such as underwater blasts during oil expiration are linked to problems such as the bends in these animals. They're trying to figure out ways if slowly increasing the man-made sounds underwater can prevent the issue. So I guess that means if you have to blast underwater, you've got to slowly crank up the Metallica for an hour or two before the blast until you can equalize the sound, and then you have your explosion without bending any dolphins.
Crazy.
You know, that's something else. And I got to say, Metallica underwater just sounds like a good time overall.
Well, that was my idea. That wasn't the article's idea, but
Okay. Because like we got the four of us on the podcast right now. We could throw on some Four Horsemen and just go for a crazy dive. But anyhow, I'm getting sidebarred into a different thing here. So
it's an interesting confirmation of mammalian dive reflex too, right? Ultimately, that's what, you know, competitive free divers in general. But if you compete and train, that's kind of one of the things you try to do is lower your heart rate.
Right.
As well. But also the, you know, the underwater sound pollution being such an issue, it's interesting to see that research would find yet more evidence to see how damaging that is to marine life.
Oh,
yeah. What's interesting is just locally, yesterday a video was released from Hakai Institute, just off Vancouver Island here. And they did a study in conjunction with Orca Lab about noise pollution and humpback whales and gray whales in the area. And, you know, it's proven it definitely disturbs them. And it's a really interesting video if you get time to watch that.
We'll have to look that up. Yeah,
I'm definitely going to check it out. It's, you know, when you look at the type of research that's being done there, you see it in humans. And obviously, like, you know, you have these animals that are highly adapted to the water. It would make sense that they have better control over these issues. But there's a documentary, and for the life of me, I can't remember it, but I was watching bits and pieces of it. And they were dealing with biathletes. So these are like the guys that are skiing and then, you know, have to immediately stop and shoot. So obviously from a sniper standpoint, like you have to reduce your heart rate very quickly. And so it shows that like these guys, their ability to like rapidly reduce their heart rate is significantly higher than the population. So, I mean, you take this and throw it into a dolphin. Millions of years of evolution, and of course they're going to be amazing at doing something like that, right? So it kind of makes logical sense too when you think about training your body.
Yeah, really cool. Well, we'll see see as they continue on that research with more, you know, like whales and different species, and see where all that all goes. A quick follow-up about the still unfolding story of the MV Conception that was destroyed by fire in California. The captain has now been charged with 34 counts of seaman's manslaughter, quote, by his misconduct, negligence, and inattention to his duties, end quote. All 33 passengers and one crew member perished in the accident, and the captain and the other four crew members survived. For more on the story, look for the link in our show notes. We said we'd follow up as new information came out, so we're just sharing that with everybody. That's it for today's news. It's time to dive in with Maxwell Hahn. You're based in British Columbia. Is that where you had your first encounter with the ocean, Maxwell?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on the Sunshine Coast, British Columbia, and I was, you know, very spoiled with where I grew up. I was surrounded by lakes, the ocean, rivers, and I was always in the water. Every chance I had to get in the water, usually during the summer, I'd jump on it. And it was ultimately what led me to diving and then pursuing a career in the diving industry.
Why did you decide to take up scuba diving?
My original plan was to go to film school. And I had about 3 months to kill before university started. So I went traveling to Central America, and I found myself in the little island of Utila in Honduras. And I was doing my open water training, and I just was really envious of my instructor's lifestyle. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to put off school for a bit longer. And I stayed there for like a year and a half. I went through open water, although to instructor, and that just led me to working all around the world.
So what was it like in Utila?
It's just a mecca for backpackers to go and do their training, or for people that want to become a dive instructor or dive master. It's just a great place to do it. Warm water. I mean, your attire is just flip-flops and board shorts. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. How would you describe what it is that you do for a living?
Well, I found in this industry, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades to really get by. My passion is videography and photography, and as you probably know, it's really tough to get your foot in the door to make a living from being like just an underwater photographer or videographer. So I really branched off and did as much as possible. I work as a scuba I worked as a scuba instructor for about 10 years, and then I got into the commercial diving industry. And I just got into marine construction, seafood harvesting, environmental surveys, working for DFO, for a variety of different fields of commercial work. And it just gave me better skills to use underwater, and also the income to be able to buy all my pricey camera and dive gear. And now I've kind of reached a point in my career where I'm truly doing what I'm passionate about, and that's underwater videography.
You seem to be one of those rare recreational divers and commercial divers. What do you think's different there for you? Sounded like the commercial side of your diving is a little bit more interesting, I guess, maybe than the kind of, you know, fixing the sewer pipe.
Yeah, it's just such different worlds. Mm-hmm. And every time you meet a commercial diver versus like a recreational instructor, they're just two separate, different career paths, and they don't really mix and match. Commercial divers, there's so many in the industry that they just work underwater. They don't necessarily like being underwater, but their job, you know, whether they're skilled in construction, it's just in a water element. So I've kind of branched off and explored every avenue I possibly could. And commercial diving was just a means of to make a good solid income to be able to afford a house, mortgage, and car.
Not to mention a nice underwater camera.
That's right. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit of some of the work that you'd done as a, you know, as a diver in that realm of, because I think for the most of the people probably listening, even for me, I have no experience in commercial diving. So like what would that have been like for you? What kind of projects did you get involved with?
Thing with working underwater, there's so many different projects that can happen, but nobody sees them because they're underwater in remote parts across the world. But I've, you know, I work on pipelines that are in a muddy environment where you literally don't have any visibility at all. You can't even see, you know, past your mask or your helmet. And those environments, you just have to learn how to see with your fingers. And so you just feel everything and you make a mental map of how to navigate that environment. So it makes you a much more confident diver. But so I'd work on those kind of projects, seafood harvesting, like urchins, red, green, sea cucumbers, gooey ducks, picking those, doing environmental surveys. So one of the surveys I usually do is the herring spawn. And each year the herring spawns along the coast of British Columbia, and I'll go out and collect the underwater data for how much spawns in the area. But yeah, I mean, there's so much work that can be done underwater, and it's kind of cool to explore all those avenues.
It sounds pretty interesting. I mean, when you think about that overall, because you're getting such a diverse scope on the work that you're doing, right? So, I mean, I it's funny because you're talking about zero vis diving, and I'm thinking in my head, like I keep trying to simulate environments where, you know, even including throwing masks on to cover my mask to say, well, I wonder what this would be like if it was a complete zero vis and you're there physically doing work in that type of an environment. How long does it take for you to get comfortable in that?
Well, it usually starts with the training. So I actually worked as a commercial diving instructor for 5 years at a school here on the island. And how we'd train our students for zero visibility conditions was just to put duct tape over their mask. And, you know, say, hey, go down and tie 10 knots and put this this pipe flange together without dropping any of the nuts or bolts or washers. And you soon get quick at learning how to navigate with just touch. And
So it sounds like I got to go to the hardware store.
That's right.
I got some good the Gorilla duct tape. I think it'll stick on underwater pretty well.
I imagine.
Maxwell, I got to ask you about cheese diving. What's that about?
So a lot of places there's, you know, if they're making different products, like, and it's a big vat of like very expensive products, they don't want to drain it to fix something that's in this big vat. So there's situations where the best and most cost-effective way for a solution is just to send a diver in. So in this liquid cheese vat, they needed a flange change though. So they chose to use a diver, then drain the cheese, right? I've dove in some pretty weird stuff.
That, you know, I'm not sure I was prepared for that one.
I have dove in effluent ponds as well. And, you know, it's hot caca. It's not pleasant. And the temperature of these ponds is 40 degrees Celsius. and I was diving them in the middle of winter when it was, you know, minus 12. So it's freezing. You don't want to put any thermals on underneath your hazmat suit, but you don't want to, you know, overheat in these effluent ponds.
That's wild.
Yeah. It's
What kind of, when you say your hazmat suit, what are you wearing when you go into these places? Because we had the RCMP underwater recovery team, a couple of guys from there, and they were talking about the suits that they wear. These Viking vulcanized rubber suits, they can scrub them down with bleach and all the rest of this. So what are you wearing when you're going into your cheese vats?
Yeah, exactly the same thing. But usually they'll buy the suit for the job, and then that suit's just used for that one job. And
one time use. Right. Wow.
Yeah. It's going to get expensive.
That's pretty good. You know what? That's insane when you think about it. Like, yes, come on in. Yeah, like we're... Like how much cheese? I'm just trying to picture this. Like how much cheese in this vat is actually worth the cost of a dry suit to actually hire a person to come in here and dive in it? That is a fantastic story.
Well, I mean, they'd hang it up and use it for more cheese jobs.
I suppose.
That's a future cheese-related diving.
That's fantastic.
I was sort of really interested to see that you're one of those divers that also spans a spectrum. So like from free diver to tech diver, including cave. And I kind of do the same. I'm like a free diver and a rebreather diver. So it's always nice to see somebody that does that. But because most people usually specialize in one or the other, right? Like Amit's a hardcore side mount diver, for example. I'm just teasing him. Yeah.
We all have our faults.
What do you get from each of these different types of diving? And like, why not specialize in one, for example?
I mean, you can only go so far with just one avenue of diving. You gotta try it all. I push myself every year. I do a couple different courses, whether it's rebreather, cave, side mount, free diving. I kind of want to just learn everything I possibly can for an underwater world and to, you know, make myself into a better diver. I went fully through the whole commercial training and worked years as a commercial diver. And then I took my cave diving training afterwards. And I realized that it applies to a lot of the commercial jobs that I worked on. And, you know, they all benefit each other.
Tell me a little bit, because I know Nick and I keep like ribbing each other about this and we keep promising to go to the Bahamas at some point, but tell me about your cave diving experiences, man. How did you get involved in that?
So I actually just did my cave training in January this year. Before COVID kicked off, I was down in the cenotes doing my courses there. I took the course. It's something I wanted to do for years. And I mainly took it because there's some caves on Vancouver Island that I really want to explore, but I just wanted to do it properly. Mm-hmm. So I'm still new to it, but I'm hoping that I'll definitely dive more into, you know, the cave realm and go do my rebreather cave training and that sort of thing.
It's pretty cool.
When you were going through that process, then did you do the zero to hero, or did you do this like through a specific processes, like, you know, one then the other and dive for a while as a cavern diver? How did you approach it?
Well, I did lots of cavern diving like throughout my travels. Like I never had taken the course. I've always just kind of done, you know, little bits here and there, nothing like not going into the cave deep or anything. But when I decided to do the cave training, I just booked for the full cave course. So it's only like, it's like 10 days or something like that, so it's not too time consuming, but it's definitely worth it, I'd say.
And overall, would you say that you're, you know, obviously I've spoken to a lot of people about this and they would suggest that your pre-dive preparation will make or break your cave training. So it's like, how well do you prepare before you come for cave training? How would you say that your previous diving experience, say in cheese and other mediums, has helped you in this case, like to be able to make it through the cave courses?
Well, for example, like being used to zero visibility conditions really, that helped me a lot for the cave training, because the instructor would black me out, spin me in circles, guide me to a certain part of the cave and push me into the corner. And then I'd have to navigate myself out. And no matter what he threw at me, I had no problem and I was totally comfortable.
That's fantastic.
Do this all day. I do this all day.
you mentioned caves on the island, in Vancouver Island. So there's like Canada doesn't come up as like a cave big caving destination in most people's minds.
It's kind of a secret.
Okay.
But no, it's not. Vancouver Island has tons of caves. It's loaded with cave systems, but really? A lot of it's kept kind of, you know, secretive. Mm. People don't want to share their caves, but there is one that is quite well known that if you get a chance to look it up, it's called Wet Dreams, and it's got middle of Vancouver Island, and it goes on for kilometers. It's a really unique system. And like, it's just a tiny little entrance in a little riverbed that you'd never know it was there. And yeah, it's quite amazing.
Cool. So in a few years time, we'll get you back on here and you can tell us all about your discoveries.
That's right.
Having so much experience diving in BC, like how would you describe like the diving there for listeners if somebody has never been to BC?
I've been pretty privileged in being able to, dove all over the world. Mostly focused on warm water destinations, to be honest. And then I kind of saved Canada for last. And I knew that, you know, eventually I'd move back and settle down in Canada. So I didn't do too much diving around here until, you know, I moved back as a commercial diver. But, I mean, the life is phenomenal. Everything just seems bigger. You know, when you look at an octopus in the Caribbean, it's, you know, maybe a couple of feet big at the most. But here they're like 20 feet long. The monsters. And like the, you know, plumose anemones, the strawberry anemones that just cover the walls here. When you get the right set of lights onto some of the walls, like in Discovery Passage, it's more vibrant than anywhere I've seen in tropical waters.
That's incredible. So what's the best time of year then to come and dive there?
Every season offers something different. If you're set on diving in the ocean, then I'd say the winter months, January, February, March, are typically the best for clarity,
okay, and
visibility. In summer, the vis kind of drops down just due to the algae and plankton blooms. But that being said, when summer rolls around Vancouver Island, I focus my attention on the rivers and the lakes because we've got these crystal clear river canyons that are absolutely amazing. You get, you know, thousands of salmon swimming around you. It's like something that you'd experience in the ocean with a school fish, but in these tinier environments, and like the whole river is just absolutely plugged with salmon. It's pretty cool.
Almost swimming with them a lot, like in a river that's literally alive at that moment, right? While you're in it. That sounds like it'd be really neat. So I did have a question that I was going to ask you related to the visibility components, because I managed to end the size of the things that you see there. Like, what do you think accounts for that? Because I'd never even seen the Pacific. And in January, I ended up there for the first time in BC and saw one of these big octopus, the giant or great Pacific octopus. And it was probably one of the coolest experiences I've ever had diving. This thing came out to play with us. He was shaking hands with us. And the sheer strength of it when it wrapped a tentacle around my arm, I was like, this is not going to be fun if he decides that he wants more of me. So like, you know, what's accounting for like just the sheer difference in size in the Pacific versus the Atlantic? Cause we don't see that stuff around here.
Yeah. I mean, everything's bigger, even like a nudie branch. If you compare there's so many people that are fascinated with nudies like in Asia and South Pacific and, you know, that they're like an inch big, like they're so small. Or a size of grain of rice. Out here, they're as big as my head. They're monsters. Wow. But I think because there's so many nutrients in the water, things grow a lot bigger. But I'm no scientist or anything. But
So you got a favorite spot that you like to go to check this stuff out, or a favorite spot for photography that you're into? Because, I mean, for me, when I went, they said, if you want to go see octopus, go to Madrona, the deep wall, and it's going to be incredible. And they weren't lying. Like, so as like from a photographer standpoint, where would you look to go?
Well, the beauty about Vancouver Island is, you know, you got these shore dives, these boat dives, these luxurious resort dives. There's all different levels. So for affordability, it's great. I mean, you get a truck with some tanks and you go to the local shore dive sites. And, I mean, I would say if you were to come to Vancouver Island, you have to check out Discovery Passage.
Okay.
Just out of Campbell River. It's amazing. It's got these just really vibrant walls and it's just thriving with marine life. But the most common place that everyone wants to go to is God's Pocket. And that's, that's rightly so. That place will absolutely blow your mind. It's incredible. I just dove it for the first time last month, and I just couldn't believe it. Hmm. Best place I've ever been in the world.
So tell me about that then. What makes it so amazing?
Well, you have these sheer walls that go on for hundreds of feet, and the entire wall is covered in life. And it's, you know, these metridiums, these yellow sponges, these strawberry anemones. So it's just this vibrant display of colors. But then you've got like the giant Pacific octopus coming out and going to collect dinner, whether they got some crabs or cockles in their hands. Mm. The wolf eels are swimming along these walls and schools of widow rockfish. And then, you spend your dive on these walls. And then when you come up into the shallows, you're greeted by these magnificent kelp forests. And these kelp forests are, you know, little nursery places for juvenile fish. So you've kind of got it all. It's just such an amazing environment. It's so hard to explain. You just got to see it for yourself.
Wow. Hmm. It's hard to believe that that's here in Canada, right? When you talk about it like that. So yeah, I'm going to have to put that on the two dive list.
Yeah.
I used to dive a lot in Southern California, and there was some magical spots, but it was never quite that vibrant with life, with like you're talking about. So definitely on my list to dive. And talking about those dive spots, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'm interested to hear about some migrations that you've recorded lately, specifically the tadpoles. So we'll chat about that more after this break. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. And in these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge, big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to our chat with Maxwell Hone on Dive In the Podcast. So, Maxwell, you recently released a wild and wonderful short film called Tadpoles, The Big Little Migration. And we encourage every listener to go out there and look at it. It just blew my mind. Why did you decide to make the film?
Well, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I mean, it was a passion project. I was exploring the freshwater lakes and rivers, and I came across these tadpoles. And at first, like when I first saw them, I didn't really know too much about them. My focus was to get some pictures of the lily pads. And as I was weaving in between the lily pads, getting some photos, I started to notice the tadpoles trickling in. Mm-hmm. And then after spending more time in the water, I started to notice hundreds and thousands and then millions. It was just this amazing event that was taking place only 2 feet below the surface. And so I went to this location over and over the years to kind of get more and more footage and learn the behavior of these little tadpoles. And I really formed this emotional connection with them. When you get a macro lens and you look at their little features, their eyes and their mouths, you can't help but fall in love with the little creatures. They kind of look like little dolphins or something like that. And so I decided to put all this footage together and make a video to share with the world. Because they are a threatened species and not too many people know too much about them. And unfortunately, once they've gone through their metamorphosis and they come out as little toadlets, they have to cross a lot of roads. And that's where a lot of people will drive over them not knowing what they are. Because at that stage, they're, no bigger than a dime. They're really quite small. So I thought sharing some of the knowledge behind the species with the public will really help to maybe give these guys a little chance. And it was really well received in the world. Everyone loved the video. And I, it's done really well.
Speaking of hazards, you got this insane footage of insects and a leech like catching these tadpoles. Like what was that, pure luck, or you kind of seen that before and you thought you put in the more time to? I mean, it took you 4 years to film it, right?
Mm-hmm. So I had seen this behavior a couple times, but it wasn't when I had a camera in my hand, and so I kept going back to try and capture this because I thought it'd be really good for the documentary, and so it just meant me spending a lot of time in the water to try and find this event happening again. And it's quite, you know, gruesome seeing the leech, you know, devour these tadpoles whole, but it's all part of the important story. And and actually that water bug that we're feeding on the tadpole's eyes was something that's never been recorded. So I have a manuscript right now that's been submitted for to record that data, and then next year we're going to go and record some more information from it.
It's amazing video. I watched it in researching this episode, and then I have a 3 and a 6-year-old, and I was like, you guys are going to love this video. Yeah. And they absolutely did. And, you know, technically it's beautiful. It's just so crisp and clear, you know, but I got to imagine filming all those tadpoles and, you know, it's just got to be challenging. What is that like?
It's tough. I mean, they're so small, and when there's thousands of them, they're kind of fearless. They're not, like, they're in the early stages that they don't really mind you being in their environment. If anything, they come to you and they land on your camera dome and land on your hands, and it almost makes it impossible to get a shot because they're too close to the camera. So in that sense, it's very tricky. And because it's you know, it's a lake bottom, so it's fine loose substrate, and any, you know, sudden movement or even the tadpoles stir up the visibility, so it's it's tough, but it was well worth it.
That sounds very cool. And, you know, I think it came through the work that you put in there, where I think you even discussed like filming it absent tanks. And what's the response to the film been like?
It's been amazing. It's only leading to more. My idea was to put this out for hopefully something bigger to happen. And hopefully something like that happens. We'll see. But, you know, it's mostly the public, this appreciation for this little critter that a lot of people didn't know about. So, you know, this season we managed to get some road signs to put up to let people know about the migration happening. And yeah, it's been great.
I was just kind of curious, because we keep talking migration. What's the distance that they cover?
Every day they're traveling like kilometers in this lake. So you'd think trying to find millions of tadpoles would be easy, but they're never where you expect them to be. And I would spend hours each day just trying to find them, because they're always moving, they're always feeding. So
yeah, what I thought really fascinating was that you have these trails made by beavers, right, that are they're cutting out the trail in lilies. I found that super fascinating.
During this process or after this process, you had partnered with any of the researchers or any researchers on this, or if it was just like a, you know, as you put it together, people gained interest.
As I put it out there, people gained interest. My emails and phone was going crazy with people all over the world that wanted to you know, dive more into the research of this species.
And so have you been connected with anyone in particular from that research side of it to say like, hey, you know, obviously you mentioned that the beetle, which is kind of gruesome, but eating the eyes of the tadpole had never been filmed before. I'm sure if you're a researcher looking into stuff like this, it would be something where that's going to raise some interest. Like, have you gotten anything like that?
I do. Well, I'm going to wait till next year to put out some announcements on that.
Gotcha.
It's a story to come, and then maybe another video.
All right, I'll leave that alone for now. As much as I want to keep going, I'm going to leave it alone.
we will stay tuned. Good luck with that.
We've been talking about what you're doing now, but you began documenting the underwater world early on in your diving career. How'd that evolve to what you do today?
I just started with a GoPro. I shot with what I had and what I could afford at the time, and I just slowly started to get better and better at my skill of shooting underwater. And it's, you know, it's also really important for these type of environments to be skilled as a diver. You know, you really gotta dial in your buoyancy to be able to get these steady shots. And you know, it's a lot of multitasking. So the buoyancy, watching your air, watching like your overall position in the water, and then also trying to focus on the marine life. It's a lot of task loading, but it's just so rewarding when you get to that kind of point where you can shoot a steady video of a large pelagic animal, or, you know, it's a tiny little tadpole.
Yeah. We've had a couple photographers on recently and echoed the same thing. Start with what you have and master it and move on kind of thing and grow. And it's just excellent advice in general, I guess.
For somebody that, you know, sees a diver with, you know, big, you know, full frame rig, obviously it's not an overnight thing. Like what advice do you have for a new diver that's kind of looking up to someone and wants to get into that space?
Well, it's all baby steps. I mean, you know, start with a point and shoot. You know, you don't have to dive into the expensive realm of full frame or DSLRs right away. Make sure you love it and you're passionate about it before you bite the bullet and you invest tens of thousands of dollars into that gear. A lot of people invest that money thinking that they're going to make it back right away, but it's not always the case. So make sure you've got, you know, backup skills to make an income. But yeah, just get out, get in the water as much as possible, whether it's, you know, going out for an ocean dive, just snorkeling in the river or the lake that's next to you. I mean, there's so many environments to practice your skills in.
Definitely. And one of the other things we noticed is you're a brand ambassador for Huish Outdoors, a brand that my dive shop, Torpedo Rays, that I manage, sells a whole lot of those brands. How did you become a brand ambassador for them?
I was lucky. You know, I just worked really hard at being an underwater photographer and diving into all these different industries of diving. And they saw that. They saw that I was a commercial diver, that I was a tech diver, a recreational instructor. And they noticed that, and they approached me and they offered me to shoot with their brands.
Very cool. One of the things that we always like to make sure we do is offer you an opportunity to tell our listeners where they can find you. So want to open that space up for you and just let us know where they might look for your online work.
Yeah, well, the one thing with me is my name is spelt really weird. It's just Maxwell with one L. So there's only one of me in the world.
Okay.
But if you punch in Maxwell Hone, that's my website, that's my Instagram, that's my Facebook. You'll be able to find me. Most active, best for reference is probably the website and Instagram. But I'm always open to answering messages, whether it's advice about gear or photography, videography, or just, you know, in a career as a diver. If people are out there looking to become a commercial diver or a recreational instructor, you know, feel free to shoot me a message and I'll be happy to give some advice.
Do you sell some of your prints online? Because I know one of our locals, Krista, has one of your prints up in her house.
I do. Yeah, I have. I have several online on my website, but I also have quite a few more that are coming soon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, some pretty sweet photos on your Instagram, and if somebody gets a print, they wouldn't be disappointed, I'm sure.
Thanks.
So, what keeps you diving, Maxwell, after all these years?
There's so much unknowns in the water. You know, every time I dive, I come across a new species that interests me, whether it's, you know, large or small. There's just so many unique things about the underwater world, and it's addictive. You know, I want to go in and film it all. Being a videographer and photographer, it's just, you know, I got to get in the water as much as possible. I mean, one dive, you've got 45 minutes, an hour to hopefully get a couple photos that you might be happy with. So it's a lot of work, but it's, you know, it's so worth it once you get one of those photos that you're really happy with.
Making those memories is what what diving's all about for so many people. And that's really great to hear. We're going to chat a little bit more about a few things. We hope you can stay with us here for a few more minutes, Maxwell. Tonight's gearing up segment, we are going to discuss a bit about the different varieties of dry suits and what some of the options are. Maxwell, in case you're not familiar with it, we run some different segments. And one of the things that our listeners requested is just some more kind of baseline information instead of all the time, all the highest level stuff. So I'm going to break the dry suits down for everybody here tonight. So dry suits are dry suits. They're not warm suits. So one of the things people often forget about is you have to wear things underneath them. So when you're buying a dry suit, don't forget to look at the undergarments. Number one thing I tell people all the time. probably the oldest school, or maybe the most common dry suits are the neoprene dry suits. They're the warmest. They're not warm, but they're warmer than the other varieties. And they're least likely to need real undergarments in warmer water, warmer cold water where you're using your dry suit. Mostly back zip. The suit compresses at depth, so it's never a good idea to overweight yourself, but especially in a neoprene dry suit, you don't want to be overweighted. There's also compressed neoprene dry suits down to 4 and 2 millimeters usually, oftentimes front zip. Those take out some of those compression at depth issues and give you that option for the front zip self-donning suits, which are really popular and the way to go, in my opinion. You've also got laminates. Laminates tend to come in self-entry or back entry. You can usually pick, except for the higher end suits, they tend to be front zip only, as you can imagine. It's just what people want to pay for. The lightest weight, cheapest suits are generally the bi-laminate suits. They work well. They're like diving in a Ziploc bag, but if you want to be dry and you want to save some money, that's a good way to do it. There's also tri-laminate suits. These are most probably the most popular dry suit on the market. They're lightweight, flexible, and they're made of, you know, 3 layers of material. They're generally pretty rugged, and the more money you spend, the more rugged they get. So aside from those main categories, there's a few specialty suits, and we actually spoke about earlier in Maxwell's interview, like the rubber suits, like the Viking suits. They can be fully decontaminated. Most divers don't need to be able to fully decontaminate their suit, but you know, it's there. I know some recreational divers that use them, you know, and they do come with the costs as well. There's also a few really specialty suits like the Fusion dry suits from Aqualung. They're a little bilaminate bag with an elastic suit over the top. Those are really nice. I have one. It's it makes it feel like a wetsuit, and you tend to not need quite as much weight as compared to some other dry suits. When it comes to those Fusion suits, though, there is one drawback that you have to know. They take a forever to get on. Everybody else will be suited up, and you'll be still fighting to get your feet in the socks. Anyway, you have some options as far as the way the suits are sealed up. Seals are consumables, so latex is easy to replace, easy to trim, all around easy, but it has the shortest lifespan. It will tend to melt or dry rot. Neoprene is warmer and more comfortable, but not every dive shop installs them in-house, and you can't adjust them as much after installation, so you better measure right the first go. But I've seen 15 or 20 year old dry suits with the original neoprene seals on them still, so I guess they last a bit longer. Silicone's probably the most popular for the people who want the most comfortable fit and the best, you know, kind of best of both worlds. They tend to last a bit longer than latex due to using a ring system to install them, because you can't glue them in a suit. You can change them on the site, so that's really, really handy with the modular rings. Lastly, a couple suit options. You can do things like pockets, knife pockets, shortening length and legs. You can add dry gloves. I really like Kubi drive gloves systems right now. It's not the cheapest, but they're super low profile. After having years and years with SciTech ring systems, I really like the low profile Kubi ones now. And one other thing I like is I move my jump valve to my forearm from the shoulder. So I am I'm a bigger guy. I'm 6'2". I'm a larger man. And sometimes reaching across to get the dump valve on my left shoulder is a little challenging. So having it on my left forearm is super handy for me, and I really like it. Maxwell, what kind of suit do you like? What are you wearing these days?
Oh, I've got all kinds of suits. I actually own about 9. got one for every day of the week, that's for sure.
If you had to pick a favorite.
My go-to is the crushed neoprene. I really like the Bare Century Tech Dry. I've been using that one for the past 3 years, and it's great. It's got the front zip. It's got nice thigh pockets. It's really good for abrasions and just, you know, wear and tear. I do a lot of commercial work, so I need a suit that can, you know, withstand some punishment. And if I were going to wear like a bag suit, it wouldn't last very long.
It's a great recommendation. I appreciate that, especially coming from a commercial diver that tends to carry a little bit more weight with when you speak about durability. So that's great to know. Mitt, you ready to chat about some side mount?
So I'm not 100% sure I'm ready to chat about side mount, okay. But hey, why not give it a go, right? And we'll see how we go. One of the things that I wanted to kind of chat a little bit about, because I think last time we were talking about sort of the pros and cons of side mount, and you know, try to keep this a little bit short. And I think where Maxwell has the, you know, the side mount certifications, I'm going to get his input as well. But One of the things that comes to mind to me is the importance of actually selecting an instructor for side mount. And so this has been spoken about, I think, in a number of different realms, as well as podcasts. I think if anyone is interested in side mount diving specifically, they have probably stumbled across Steve Davis's Speaking Side Mount. And I think there's a lot to be said for getting some proper instruction as you move into that that realm of side mount. So, you know, when you start in with side mount, what you're dealing with is obviously doubling up all of your gear. So you're going to bring two tanks into the water, you're bringing two regs into the water. But then the other piece that you're going to have to deal with as you make that transition is you have to figure out what is the right type of harness for me. What harnesses am I going to use in cold versus warm water? How will I change those gear configurations? You know, what do I do with these crazy bungees when you get a big bag of bungees that just show up and you're supposed to figure out what you're going to do with that? And how do you make sure that your harness is trimmed out for you? And those are just things that you're dealing with before you get into the water. Once you get into the water, then you end up with this other logistical nightmare, which is that I now have all this gear on me, but I don't know what to do with any of it. And I don't know how to streamline it in a way that's going to make it effective, because I've seen, you know, folks in the water in side mount, and it's clear that they've put some thought into it, but maybe that they've not really had that level of instruction. And you'll see things like tank tails just flying up in the air and trailing in behind them. One tank completely out of trim and the other one not in, you know, in trim, or just entrances and exits into the water through different ways becoming a problem. And so I guess one of the things that I would suggest is that as you move into that that realm, it's not a requirement necessarily that you go out and say take a back mount doubles course, because it's very similar with a few exceptions, but you really should consider if you're going to do side mount as a, I guess, in take it up as a course piece, that you do it well and that you find somebody who is a capable instructor. And so I was wondering, Maxwell, what your thoughts might have been as you kind of progressed through your side mount training, and you know, whether you think that holds water.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with everything you said there. It's vital to have an instructor that knows the system inside and out. Unfortunately, when I first started my side mount diving, I didn't have the best instructor. I was taught pretty incorrectly, and I soon found that out from my friends who I went diving with. And
okay.
I was corrected well then. But yeah, so you need an instructor that knows your system. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a Polis Katana or X Deep or a Razor side mount system, you need an instructor that knows that system and that can really properly streamline you and your gear. It's a lot to learn, and it's a lot of pieces of gear to get into the right position, and it just takes time, lots of diving and practice, and I really found that my instructor would take a GoPro and he'd film me in the water to show me what I look like with my streamlining. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me for you know, our briefings to see exactly what was happening, especially for skills, you know, whether you're switching regulators or tucking things away. And that's really important stuff that you need to learn, especially if you're going to go down into the cave realm as well.
Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of cool to hear that, because I know for me, when I first started out, I actually was always negotiating. I hadn't met Nick actually at this point. And so I was always negotiating with people who were on a dive with me, like, hey, is there any chance you could snap? I was like, I know this is awkward, but can you snap a couple of pictures of me when I'm here, here, and here, just so that I can see what's going on with my gear? Because, you know, the configuration is such that, you know, sometimes a tank might come out of trim during a part of the dive and you're not quite sure when in the dive your tank has become light. And as you kind of rotate between, you know, one type of tank, say like an aluminum tank to a steel tank, and whether that be a low pressure or a high pressure tank, then they, you know, their buoyancy characteristics are pretty particular. So I'd have guys going like, you want me to do what? And I, you know, so the ability to have video, I think, while you're in that training process is phenomenal as a tool. So yeah, very cool to hear that from a guy at your level, that you're agreeing with that. So thank you.
Thanks for that, Amit. Thanks for jumping in there, Maxwell. We throw this stuff at you and play it along well. We really appreciate it. And that does it for this week's episode of Dive in the Podcast. Thanks again to Maxwell Hone for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate being here. And yeah, make sure you guys subscribe to Dive In. And I'm looking forward to hearing your next podcast.
Awesome. Awesome. And Nick, thanks for being here tonight.
I'm going to say every week, it's been a pleasure to be here. And thank you, Maxwell, for agreeing to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
And Amit, thank you as well, sir.
I'm going to say you have definitely set the record for the most interesting dive that I've heard of yet in the the diving in cheese medium. So thank you very much, Maxwell, for coming on. And on a serious note, I do want to say your tadpole video kind of took me back to my childhood, growing up in the Caribbean. And that's what we did in a lot because we were bored. We'd go catch tadpoles. And then to watch that migration, the way that you filmed it and the way you tell the story was absolutely phenomenal. So if anybody who's listening has not taken the opportunity to go watch that video, I strongly suggest you do. And yeah, if you have kids, even better, So I look forward to what's coming as we go forward. And again, I thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks, guys.
You can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @DiveInPod. Our email is divein.thepodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, diveinpod.com. You can find our latest episodes and more on the website. On social media, you can follow me @IDiveOK, April's @AprilWeichert, Nick's @NicholasWinklerPhotography. Don't forget to go check out Nick's diver photos. He'll offer a big discount for anyone that mentions the podcast, I'm sure. You can find links to everything we mentioned on today's episode in the show notes or on the website, diveinpod.com. Next week, we speak to the first and only Bermudian certified freediver, scuba diver, and closed circuit rebreather diver, Weldon Wade. This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Head over to your favorite podcast app to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.